Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. It's about minus 15 Celsius, or 5 degrees Fahrenheit, or as we like to say in Canada, it's refreshing. Reminds me of that old Johnny Carson joke. It was so cold a flasher in Times Square was arrested for describing himself. But this is Toronto, 6 months of winter and 6 months of really bad skating. Imagine stumbling upon a 5,000-year-old Indian oracle that has your name written on it. When translated, it reveals the story of your life with 100% accuracy and proclaims what will happen in the future, even giving the exact time you'll die. The oracle tells you that to turn the tide of providence, you must go on a journey, a mystical quest, if you will. First, you'll visit a frightening holy man who sleeps in a fire. You must perform strange rituals and change people's lives through charitable acts. If this sounds like a movie script, yes, it probably could be and might be, but it also happened. It happened to Craig Hamilton Parker, a British psychic medium who's amazed audiences with the accuracy of his clairvoyance. He's best known for his British TV shows Our Psychic Family and Nightmares Decoded, and The Spirit of Diana, a televised seance during which Craig and his partner wife Jane attempted to communicate with the spirit of the late Princess Diana of Wales. It was seen by tens of millions around the world, but not in Britain, where it was banned. Craig Hamilton Parker will join me from England in the second half of this transmission, hours 3 and 4, to talk about his conversation with Princess Di, albeit from the other side, a few of his startling accurate predictions, and of course the astonishing spiritual adventure that shook his soul and left him a changed man. It's been nearly a month since the New York Times broke the story about the Pentagon's mysterious UFO program. $22 million out of a total U.S. defense budget of about $600 billion is a rather paltry sum to investigate the great existential questions of human history. Are we alone in the universe? Are we being visited by a race or races of extraterrestrials or interdimensionals? It's been discussed a lot on Coast over the last 4 weeks, and why not? It's big news. It's historic. Some in the ufology arena are calling this about the closest thing we have to official disclosure, while others are suspicious. Who is this whistleblower? Luis Elizondo, the former military intel officer who supposedly ran this program from the fifth floor of the Pentagon's C-ring. Presumably, he signed a non-confidentiality oath with the DOD, one that would be legally binding. By speaking out now, one would presume he'd be in violation of that agreement. So why is he being allowed to speak? Shouldn't we all be a little suspicious? Could Elizondo be part of a disinformation campaign? Or should we take him on his word, separate fact from fake news later, and just rejoice in the fact that the UFO ET issue has finally found its way into the Sunday edition of what once was considered the paper of record? Former Blink 182 member Tom DeLonge has hinted the Pentagon UFO disclosure is only the beginning. There's a lot more coming. Okay, we're waiting. But you'd think after the Times piece on December 16th and a follow-up article by one of that story's co-authors, Ralph Blumenthal, 2 days later, it would have ignited the conversation. But in keeping with this frustrating pattern we've all witnessed over the years, after the initial firestorm of interest, the MSM goes silent and moves on to the Golden Globes. Will Oprah run or won't she? What did POTUS tweet this morning? Kind of reminds me of the time when Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, told reporters top military officials had confirmed to him that UFOs were real and ETs were visiting the planet. That excitement lasted about 48 hours and then nothing. You'd think after a revelation like that, it would permanently arouse the intellectual curiosity of somebody working for one of the important news-gathering organizations. Stephen Bassett described the situation to me once at the National Press Club in Washington. He said, it's as if one day the New York Times reported that an asteroid was heading towards Earth, a huge rock, a planet killer, And then the next day, silence. And the story's never mentioned again. Well, I haven't seen anything meaningful following up on the Times story in 4 weeks, aside from a piece in the Sunday Review section by Dan Barry titled, "Dad Believed in UFOs. Turns out he wasn't alone." If this story is true, where, oh, where is the intellectual curiosity? Crickets. Well, the Pentagon disclosure has been covered extensively and superbly on this program. I'd like to have a whack at the old piñata, if you don't mind. And to that end, Robert Salas joins me in the first 2 hours of Coast. The retired U.S. Air Force officer will be here next to talk about aliens and nukes, the UFO cabal, his own abduction experience, and his take on the Pentagon's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. Salas was stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1967, when a number of Minutemen missiles were shut down by UFOs that were seen hovering above the missile silos. And on at least three separate occasions, all within weeks, multiple nuclear missiles were disengaged. Why doesn't the once mighty New York Times wow us and look into that, albeit 50 years on? Sort of reminds me of that old Navajo proverb. You can't wake someone who's pretending to be asleep. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come warm yourself by the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett. Why don't you stay a while? Robert Salas served almost 7 years on active duty in the Air Force until resigning in 1971. From 71 to 73, he worked for Martin Marietta Aerospace and Rockwell International on space shuttle design proposals. From 1973 until his retirement in 1995, he worked for the Federal Aviation Administration. He's the author of Unidentified, the UFO Phenomenon, and co-author of Faded Giant with co-author James Klotz, which details his UFO incident while stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Montana. Robert Salas, welcome back to Coast AM. How are you?
Thank you, Richard. Good to hear your voice again.
Likewise.
Can you hear me okay? I can,
and can you hear me?
Yes, perfect.
Excellent. All right. Your initial visceral reaction to the Pentagon disclosure, how would you characterize that, Robert?
Well, initially, I was excited because there was an official acknowledgement by the Pentagon that, yes, indeed, they had an office investigating the UFO question. But then that excitement dwindled as the days went on because I had some of the same questions you brought up and some others. Because, of course, I had to sign a non-disclosure statement never to talk about my incident. And I'm sure this being a black project, this AATIP program, being a black project would have had a very high level of security around it. So how is it that Mr. Elizondo is able to come forward, et cetera? So I'm in the same boat you are right now. I've still got a lot of questions, namely, why do we have a single source investigating this? Like it appears that Robert Bigelow was given the majority of the funds to study this, you know, why was it shut down if there was interest in doing it? And plus, as you well know, UFO studies have been going on since 1947, and each time somehow it's been dropped by the Air Force and others. So why was this brought up again? Was it just to placate Senator Reid, or was it a serious study?
Right. Or is it, as you say, we had the Condon Report, another whitewash. My good friend John Rappaport of No More Fake News, I thought in his recent blog raised a number of very important questions, and that anyone who has had access to this Luis Elizondo has failed to ask sort of the hard questions. And one of them, aside from the confidentiality oath, which he surely took, would be the fact that it's a rather interesting transition he made. One moment he's running clandestine operations in Latin America, and now he's head of this secret Pentagon UFO program. That is rather curious, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. So that's the other question I had. Why Elizondo? What background does he have in the study of the UFO phenomenon? We know that Bigelow has been interested in this for some time. You know, he was owner of the Skinwalker Ranch, which some of your listeners probably know about. He has come forward on that 60 Minute interview and said unequivocally that, yeah, we are being visited by extraterrestrial entities. So I can see why they would select Bigelow, but why make it just him? It just sounds a little fishy. You know, the majority of the funds would go just to him and his group.
The other, I think, important question, and again, let me credit John Rappaport, No More Fake News, for raising this issue, and that is, someone should ask Elizondo, has he ever attempted to leak, purposely leak, disinformation to the media? Has he been part of that whole game? In other words, what I'm asking, and this is an area of particular interest to you, you've talked about this extensively, and that is Elizondo really a whistleblower, or is he part of the UFO cabal?
Right. Well, I'm sure he's not going to admit that. But the other thing that's a bit fishy is this organization that Elizondo belongs to, this To the Stars Academy, I think it's called.
Right, Tom DeLonge's organization.
Tom DeLonge's group, which, by the way, has ex-members of Bigelow's group called NIDS, including Hal Puthoff and Colm Kelleher. And the group itself was initially pushed as a group that just wanted to get the word out there on UFOs, but it is a for-profit organization. If you go to their website, it's the corporation in the public interest or something like that. But it is a for-profit organization, so they are they're looking into this, but there's a profit to be had here. So that is very suspicious also.
Well, you know, the other interesting thing I wanted to ask you is, as someone, and I want to get into, you know, March 24th, 1967, and the incident over Malmstrom as the 2 hours progresses. But wouldn't you be far more impressed, Robert, if someone at the New York Times, whether it's Ralph Blumenthal or Helene Cooper or whomever, they got a little bit of intellectual curiosity and dove deep into the Malmstrom incident? Wouldn't you be more impressed to see that story splashed across the Sunday edition of the New York Times?
Yes, in a word. I think my story and other similar stories, which we can talk about, I've got about 14 to 16 other incidents that are similar to mine. But I think that's, you know, my story and those are very significant in this, in bringing credibility to this whole UFO phenomenon issue. And yes, I think the New York Times should focus on my story and these others. I believe I've got solid evidence in the form of witness testimony and documents in my story. And of course, I try to put these in the two books that I've written. And I speak about this all the time. If people want to go to my website, it's spiralgalaxy.org. If they go to the link that talks about the phenomenon, you'll see some of my evidence and even some of the audio evidence, some of my witnesses on there.
You, as you mentioned, took a confidentiality oath that you respected, and you weren't even going to talk about what happened at Malmstrom until you stumbled upon a book. It was Timothy Good's book. Sort of how did that unfold, where you decided it was time for you to speak about what you witnessed at Malmstrom?
Well, what happened was I picked up this book Above Top Secret by Timothy Good. I was just happened to be in a bookstore and happened to pick up the book and turn to page 301, I think it was. And there was a short paragraph on UFO incident involving missile shutdowns. So I got excited, thought that the Air Force might have declassified the incident, which I had kept secret for some 20 years. And so I decided to go ahead and write to the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act. I got Jim Klotz, a member of MUFON at the time, to send a FOIA request. I asked him not to say anything about UFOs. And sure enough, we heard back, and they said, you know, this is classified, but since it's been so long, I think there's a 12-year limit on declassification. They said they were going to go ahead and declassify the Echo flight incident. Now, because the similarity to the Echo flight incident to my own, I thought it was my incident. So as soon as we started getting documents from the Air Force, I decided to go public and disclose to the public that this was a UFO incident. And so I did. It wasn't until 2 years later when I finally contacted my commander, Fred Maiwal, who was in the capsule with me. He told me we were not at Echo Flight. We were at Oscar Flight. So I've been speaking openly about this, even though I had signed a non-disclosure for 2 years now and then, at that point. And so I decided just to keep on talking. And so far, so good. Nobody's knocked on my door, told me to stop talking about it. So well, I continue to speak up.
Because you were operating under the assumption that your situation on March 24th was unique. But then you discovered, after reading Timothy Good's book, you discovered that what he was talking about was one of actually three incidents that occurred involving Minutemen nuclear missiles in Montana.
Well, let's put that in perspective. There were just two incidents that were involved within the span of 8 days in the Great Falls, Montana area. Not the Great Falls, but the Montana area that I worked in. I was with the 351st Strategic Missile Wing and in that area. So the Echo flight happened on March 16th, 1967. Again, missiles were shut down. UFOs were seen overhead by a maintenance crew and security guards. All 10 missiles went down within seconds of each other. And that's the bulk of the material we got back from the Air Force related to the Echo flight incident. My incident occurred March 24th, 67, and this has been confirmed by other witnesses. Again, 10 missiles go down, UFO overhead over our launch control facility. Now, in 1966 at Minot, and I didn't know this at the time I wrote my last book, Dave Schindeli experienced a similar thing, only he relieved a crew whose missiles had been shut down by UFOs in Minot Air Force Base in, I think it was September of 66. There have been other incidents at Malmstrom. One of the more significant ones was in 1975. I don't know about the missile shutdowns there, but missiles, UFOs were seen over the missile sites in 1975. And there's good records for that.
And yet, in 1969, we had assurances from the Air Force that there was no threat to humankind by these UFO incursions. Well, these three, four, five, how many incidents prior to 1969 certainly lay that lie to waste. We'll take a time out, Robert. We'll come back and continue to discuss the incident at Malmstrom and also the mysterious Pentagon UFO program. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. I always suspected whoever painted the Partridge Family tour bus may have been off-planet. Just a suspicion. Richard Serrett coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Attentive viewers watching a morning newscast in Oregon were bewildered, to say the least, when they saw what appeared to be two UFOs behind the anchors as they were delivering the news. The strange scene occurred last week on Portland's KOIN as morning anchor Ken Bodie segued to the weather and traffic report. Suddenly, over his shoulder, a pair of lights seemed to streak across the sky on the big screen that shows viewers a daybreak look at the city skyline. Since the giant video wall was behind him, no one noticed the weird moment and just kept chatting away, which is something of an apt metaphor for the mainstream media's perspective on UFOs. Nonetheless, people watching the show at home did catch the strange lights and promptly began speculating about what they could have been. Some of the theories offered include lens flare, a reflection of a car's lights, and, of course, aliens. And you can see the video for yourself. Our webmaster tonight, this morning, Greg Bishop, has posted it in the highlights carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. Back with more of my conversation with Robert Salas on the mysterious UFO Pentagon Project here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, I'd like to stay with Malmstrom for a few moments yet, if you're okay with that. You don't get tired of talking about that, do you?
No, of course not. I'm happy to do so.
All right. I'd like to talk about it for a little bit, and then I'd like to talk, obviously, about the UFO cabal. So back to March 24th, 67, and you're the deputy commander at the Oscar Launch Control Facility. And right. Just sort of describe where you are. Describe this capsule that's underground.
Right. We're about 60 feet underground in a concrete hardened capsule. Hardened meaning it should be able to withstand a nuclear blast overhead. That's what we were told. Topside, we had about six guards normally, so it looks like a little ranch house in the middle of the wheat field with fencing around it. We had control over 10 Minuteman missiles, and we had, at that time, we had the ability to launch those missiles on our own. In other words, given the launch codes, we would have launched those missiles. So, and then there were possibly 15 other launch control facilities spread throughout Montana, and each again had 10 nuclear missiles under their control. So we'd be on duty for about 24 hours, and then get relieved by another crew.
And who first reported a UFO hovering over the launch facility?
We had a topside main guard called the flight security controller. He first reported lights in the sky. I didn't pay much attention to that. It seemed like he was just killing time. But then the next call I got, he was very frightened, yelling into the phone and saying there was a glowing red object hovering right above the front gate, and all the guards out there with their weapons drawn, and wanted me to tell him what to do next. I told him to make sure the place was secure. It sounded like we were under some sort of an attack. I didn't know what to think, really. It was a pretty emotional conversation. Hung up. I went to tell my commander about it. I was taking a rest break, and then all of a sudden the missiles started going down into from a go status to a no-go status within seconds. So we lost all 10 within seconds.
Who would have had the authority to authorize the use of firearms? Would that have been you or the commander?
Well, I didn't tell him to use his firearms. He had ordered his men out there to be armed. They were very frightened. All they saw was this big, bright orange, red-orange light pulsating, hovering over the front gate. They didn't know what to think, but they're trying to draw their weapons. So I did not give them an order to fire. However, I can't say that one or two of them didn't fire their weapons. In another incident, 1976, that I think it was Ellsworth Air Force Base, they did fire on these objects, of course, to no avail. But they fired about 180 rounds at UFO, and no effect.
And did the missiles, the Minutemen, did they come back online themselves, or did you have to get missile maintenance to come and get them back online?
Right. We had to get missile maintenance out there. What happened was the object was able to send a signal through 60 feet of earth and concrete and penetrate triply redundant, protected from electromagnetic interference cabling system to each missile separately. So it would have to send a signal to each one separately to upset the guidance package. So the guidance and control system, they all failed due to guidance and control system failure, a particular piece of equipment in that. So all they did was to upset the guidance system, which shut down the missiles, because without proper guidance, the missiles wouldn't know where to go if they were launched. So they were all shut down for that particular reason. We had to send targeting alignment teams, maintenance teams out to the sites to reorient the missiles, basically physically reorient the missiles so that they would be on target if launched.
So obviously this would have been of grave, grave concern to Strategic Air Command, and presumably even would have reached the desk of the White House, I would imagine, would it not?
I would think so. I would think so. One of the messages we got back from under the Freedom of Information Act said exactly that. This is of grave concern. This is from Strategic Air Command headquarters because they could not identify a cause. They said it was a grave concern to this headquarters. So, they had no idea. In fact, another document we got said that this would have been a very remote failure. So that's just kind of a nice way of saying that it was impossible for this to happen. It says here the possibility of this very remote failure due to the fact that 10 couplers would have had to fail in the flight within seconds of each other. Which is just, unheard of.
So happening once to 10 Minutemen missiles, impossible. How about three times?
Yeah, well, the same thing happened again, like I said, 8 days earlier at Echo Flight.
And what about this? The team, I guess it was it assembled by Boeing? They were brought in trying to figure out what the heck happened?
Yeah, Boeing set up a team. They were the prime contractor for the missile systems. And so they were responsible for trying to figure out any failure modes of the systems. So they set up a team. Sent people out, and they did their work and looked at all kinds of things, like power failure. By the way, we didn't have power failure. Power was on all the time. This was not a power failure issue. But they looked at that. They looked at our computers. They interviewed everybody. and could not come up with a viable cause. So they were going to write this up, and they were ordered not to, because this this came down from the head of the team, which we were in communication with, said that this was a UFO event. They were told this was a UFO event, and they did not want a final report written. And the reason they didn't want a final report written at that time was because the Condon investigation was ongoing at that time. The Condon investigation started in August of 66 and went through the end of 68. They wrote their report in 69. So, and this incident, these incidents, these two incidents, were not included in the evaluation made by Condon. And I go into that in my book. I go into the cover-up of that, but the Condon investigator, a guy by the name of Dr. Roy Craig, knew about our incidents, about our shutdowns involving UFOs. He actually went out to Malmstrom to interview people and was stonewalled, told to leave, basically, even though Condon was supposed to have access to any and all records of UFO incidents on military bases. That's what they were studying. So this was clearly a whitewash, and I go into great detail on this whitewash in my book.
How many of, besides yourself, how many of your, how many are still out there that that witnessed this, that that were investigating the shutdown? You've talked about people like UFO investigator Raymond Fowler, who was who played a part in the story of the shutdowns. He was with the Sylvania Corporation. They were looking into the electrical systems. You've talked about a gentleman by the name of
Ray Fowler is still alive and kicking. I heard from him within the last month. Colonel Walt Siegel, who was the deputy at Echo Flight, he's still alive.
Mike, how about Robert Kaminsky, who was that contractor
Robert
with
Kaminsky
Boeing?
Kaminsky has passed on.
Okay.
So is Dr. Craig. So is Edward Condon. Robert Jameson, who validated or verified the fact that all 10 missiles in Oscar Flight, where I was, went down. He was on the maintenance crews that went out there. He's still alive. Fred Meyerwald, my commander, has passed. So we do have a few people that are still speak to this. If, for example, we had a congressional hearing, which would be nice.
Yes. Yes. A real one. I mean,
yes.
Bassett's citizens hearing was fantastic.
Yes.
Now it's time for a real one. If you and some of the others involved, if you were to go to Ralph Blumenthal and say, I've got a great follow-up story for you, what do you think the reaction would be? Do you think you'd get green lit?
Excuse me, I just don't know who Blumenthal is.
I'm sorry. Ralph Blumenthal, he was one of the co-authors of the New York Times piece along with the Pentagon correspondent.
Of course.
I believe it was Aline. Yeah.
I'd be happy to speak to anyone from the press, the New York Times especially, about this. And I could, I'm sure, convince him that I've got plenty of material that he could look into that would validate my story. So I'd be happy to do that.
Well, that would be, to my mind, Robert, that would be an interesting test in terms of their sincerity on sort of pushing the needle here, moving the needle on this whole UFO ET issue.
Yeah, well, let me just say a couple of words. So at first, CNN and even MSNBC were hot on this, and of course the New York Times wrote an article, and so did other papers. And of course it went through the news cycle, and now it essentially seems to have forgotten about it. But part of the reason, I think, and this has been true in the past, is someone in DOD puts the kibosh on these stories and says, no, you don't want to go into this any further. And they kind of wilt. The press kind of wilts away from this. And I think primarily because they're afraid of losing access to DOD on other stories. They don't want to be blackballed, for example. I hate to say that, but I think that's true about the UFO phenomenon in general, that the press seems to be reluctant to follow through on these things. I've been through the whole bit with giving press releases at the National Press Club. We spoke in 2010 and then again 2013 and 2007, Steve Bassett a few times. And each time the press gets excited for a little while, and it just drops the whole thing.
One of the reasons for optimism, I thought, with the New York Times piece, and that's, whether or let's just set aside the credibility of Luis Elizondo for a moment, and that is there seems to be a palpable sea change in the tone in which the New York Times is reporting this. There's a real earnestness and a seriousness. There's no tongue-in-cheek now. So at least we can say that's an improvement. But we're coming up on top of the hour here, and we'll break, and then we'll open up phone lines. But let me ask you this now. We can continue the conversation after, and that is, let's assume that Luis Elizondo is part of this disinformation campaign. What would be the rationale for the UFO cabal to release something like this now?
Well, that's a good question. I guess it would be a little like releasing a little bit of steam. You don't want too much energy built up in a steam boiler, so you release a little bit of steam. they might throw out a bone to the public on the UFO question now and then, just to say there's something to this, but we're not going to tell you exactly what we know. I don't know. It's just hard to try to understand why they would do something like that.
Give the public something to chew on. This should keep them busy for a couple of years.
Yeah, right. I don't know. I can't read their minds, but there is definitely a UFO cabal, as you know. I believe that, and I've written a lot about that. There is a disinformation effort going on. Now, why they would that's the overall arching question on this particular group. Why would they start up a group in 2009? And ended in 2012, spend $22 million on it, and then just drop it. I mean, it just doesn't make much sense. And by the way, we had written to the president, President Obama, in 2009, and got the reply that the U.S. government has no evidence that there's anything to this, suggest there's any credibility to this. A UFO phenomenon. So why would they issue a statement like that and then at the same time, same year, start up this secret group?
Precisely. Well, Elizondo, I believe, is on the record as saying that the program does continue. His successor has been he has a successor. He hasn't named him. I'd like to hear the name. But perhaps we'll have to wait for another New York Times piece. I won't hold my breath. We'll take a time out to come back. Open up the phone lines, questions and comments for Robert Salas as we continue to delve into the Pentagon's mysterious UFO program. Paul McCartney taking us into the break with Too Many People right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E. Double T, coming to you live from Coast's Toronto, Canada affiliate, In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. We are talking with Robert Salas about the Pentagon's mysterious UFO program. The New York Times, of course, broke that story back in mid-December. We haven't heard much since. And I think you'd excuse Robert if he's not terribly impressed with that. I think he'd be far more interested if the New York Times would engage their resources and their intellectual curiosity and perhaps investigate UFO incursions over nuclear missile sites. He witnessed just such a thing back in 1967. We'll get back to that conversation and your calls in a moment. Hey, you've heard about the Battle of Los Angeles, speaking of UFOs. How about the invasion of Salt Lake City? Well, it has nothing to do with UFOs. It's George Norrie Live, coming to the Gene Wagner Theater. That's in Salt Lake City, of course, happening Saturday, March the 10th, 2018, from 5 to 8 p.m. He'll discuss, his guests will discuss ancient technology with Jason Martell, the man who died two times and lived to tell about it, Danian Brinkley, a ufologist, Nick Pope. George will also sing a few songs with a live band, and you can take part in a Q&A with each guest. So don't miss out on this. You want to get in on the action because tickets are going to go fast. You can call the box office at 801-355-ARTS, A-R-T-S, 801-355-2787. Online tickets at artssaltlake.org, artssaltlake.org, and a meet and greet following the show. All right, back to your questions and comments for Robert Salas when Coast to Coast AM continues. Robert Salas stays with us, former U.S. Air Force, former FAA official. Robert, how would you describe the UFO cabal? For example, who is it comprised of?
Well, I believe the cabal is comprised of elements or individuals with some of the intel agencies. We know the CIA has been involved almost from the beginning of the CIA. So I think there are individuals within various intelligence agencies working together with other intelligence agencies in other countries, exchanging information. I have secondhand evidence, word of mouth that this is going on. I can point to a lot of instances where countries and military organizations, intel agencies within military organizations have exchanged information with U.S. and other countries on UFOs. So, but I do think it is a viable organization that is holding these secrets for their own reasons. And, it's speculative as to what those reasons are now. Initially, I think they were trying to protect the public from some panic or some injury to our institutions, et cetera. But now I think it's more about greed, basically, because it's when you think about it, these secrets are very powerful, and they can be used as currency to exchange information and on some of these secrets.
To what extent do you think the cabal has infiltrated the mainstream media? Would they, for example? And I know I'm asking you to speculate, or maybe you have some secondhand information or firsthand information, but to what extent has the cabal infiltrated, let's say, the editorial section of the mainstream media, the editorial board, or the management of television networks and so forth?
That I have no idea. I haven't even thought about them infiltrating editorial boards of newspapers or media. I think they do infiltrate UFO groups and UFO organizations because that's where some of the action is. They want to know what the public knows or what these investigators know about the subject. I think the way they apply influence on editorial opinions and newspapers is, like I said, giving and taking away access to government agencies, which is kind of a lifeblood for most of the newspapers and media. They want to make sure that they have contacts within government so they can, write stories. And so I think that is the primary way they control things.
All right, let's go to the wild card line. Sean is in Columbus, Ohio. Sean, welcome to Coast AM.
Hi. Pleasure to be with you tonight. This is a subject that I've, read about quite a bit, but there's a question that I have never heard an answer to. Was anyone ever able to determine how the UFOs shut the missiles down? And if so, were they ever able to create something to protect the missile so it doesn't happen again?
Ha ha. All right. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah. Actually, Boeing thought they isolated a particular piece of equipment. Let's see if I can remember what it's called. But I don't recall the exact piece of equipment, but they were able to do a bench test and say that if a particular signal reached this piece of equipment in the guidance system, that it would create the shutdown sequence of the missile. But like I said, the objects, the UFOs, would have had to send a particular signal to this particular piece of equipment to each of the missiles separately and within seconds of each other. So we, of course, had nothing in our inventory that could have done anything like that then or now in the method that I described. So I doubt that we have anything installed that might protect against a similar thing in the future.
But, Sean, thank you for that. Good question. West of the Rockies, Howard is in Vancouver, Washington. Howard, good morning, good evening. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hello, Richard and Robert. I had a thought I'd like to throw out there regarding these missile shutdowns that occurred. Perhaps the shutting down the ICBMs was merely incidental to what their real objective was. Perhaps they were actually trying to hack into NORAD's computers so they could find the total extent of our defensive capabilities. What might you think of that?
I don't think that what they're trying to do is, let's say, disable us from self-protection or disable our nuclear weapons as a whole, or our ability to detect incoming missiles or anything like that. I just think that what they did was a message, and that message was get rid of the nuclear weapons. They did not damage our missiles. They simply disabled them temporarily. There was no damage to any of the equipment. I don't consider what happened to me as being a aggressive attack per se by extraterrestrials. Again, this happened over 50 years ago. If the ETs wanted to do damage to our military capability, they could have done a lot worse then and in the interim.
Howard, thank you for that. If they, whoever they are, have the capability of shutting down 10 Minutemen nuclear missiles with a snap of a finger, I would suggest that in their eyes we don't have a defense system. Maybe that's part of the rationale for the cabal keeping a lid on this secret, Robert. They know we're defenseless and they don't want to panic us. The public, that is, or that may have been initially their concern.
Well, yeah, that certainly makes sense. That if the government admitted that we have no way of protecting ourselves from what these objects can do, to our most sophisticated weapons. That would be pretty embarrassing, and what could they say then? You know, we're just at their mercy.
Speaking of nukes, if the UFOs, the pilots of these craft, are concerned about our handling and our use of nuclear weapons, the question that jumps to my mind immediately is, where were they during Nagasaki and Hiroshima, even before that, at Trinity?
Well, in my book, I point out that in 1945, before the first test, the first nuclear bomb, UFOs were seen over Hanford nuclear site, and that's where the plutonium, I believe, is being refined at Hanford, Washington. And so there is a record of that, 1945, before the first atomic bomb test. There have been witnesses at other nuclear weapons testing. I think they've been around for a while. And of course, they were seen during World War II.
Oh, they've been around, sure. Ezekiel's wheel, I mean, thousands and thousands of years. But could they not have stopped Hiroshima and Nagasaki if they had wanted to? Surely they could have.
Oh, now you're talking about another thing. Yeah. Yes, they probably could have. So that begs the question, would they in the future stop a nuclear war? Hard to say. I'm not so sure. I think what they want us to do is to figure out a way to get rid of these weapons because they're not weapons of war. They're weapons of mass destruction. And all they can do is, if we went into war, is create havoc with our civilization and possibly do us all in.
If the pilots of these crafts are extraterrestrial, let's say they're from Sirius or Andromeda or someplace like that, wouldn't a nuclear blast on Earth be like lighting a match, 100 miles away? No one would take notice. And unless they're in our own galactic backyard or they're here.
Yeah, one of the critical questions is, what are they doing here? What is their agenda? And I think the fact that they are here and have been here for a long, long time shows that they are interested in us, how we are handling things here, how we are protecting the planet, and possibly worried about if we destroy our own planet, or if we go start investigating other planets, which we intend to do shortly. We're going to be sending people to Mars. How are we going to handle that? In other words, are we going to respect those other planets? Undoubtedly, there's life out there somewhere, and how are we going to interact with that life? So, I think part of the reason they're here is they're monitoring how we're handling things. And so far, I don't think we're doing too well.
West of the Rockies, Richard's in Palm Desert, California. Richard, good morning, good evening.
Good evening. I was a guard on a Minuteman II missile on Vandenberg Air Force Base about September 1964. And those were not armed missiles. We would send them down the Pacific test range to test the missile. And the condition of that missile is what we called green was an empty silo, or amber was a silo with a missile in it, but not ready for launch. And then red, we didn't put guards on the red, just on the ambers and greens. And it was the night shift. And I was approached by this, I'm going to call it an entity. It came out of the fog. It was a foggy night, and the missiles were silos were lit up with a large overhead light that kind of reflected out the fog, but I could see the shadow coming out. I actually thought it was an Air Force officer because he seemed to be wearing a trench coat and very humanoid in appearance. And as he came towards me, I realized that there was something very, very wrong. And we were armed, and I had a 38 Smith & Wesson, and actually intended to pull that Smith & Wesson, and I was totally paralyzed. There was nothing I can do, and just went into complete panic. And the next thing I knew, I was just out cold. Apparently, in the morning, and it was several hours later when I came to, that enemy was entity was with me, but didn't want me to look over at it. But it was communicating with me, and it was just saying it was sorry that it had scared me so bad, but they needed to see the missile. And you know, the Minuteman had a ring around the top, under entered through a separate access door, that had the launch computers in it because they had to be separate. They couldn't be connected to main computer banks because each missile was fired separately or independent. And apparently, they wanted to go down and check out that equipment, which I really feel later, as I heard about Maelstrom, that they wanted to be able to know enough about that equipment to disable it. But so that was my experience. I never told anybody.
Richard, that is absolutely fascinating, mind-blowing. You've never shared this with anyone before.
Oh, yeah. I actually shared it with Art Bell, maybe.
All right.
And,
well, thank you. Can I make a comment about that?
Please, Robert, go ahead.
I have been in contact with a witness, a very credible witness, who was on the one of the maintenance teams that went out to one of the Echo Flight missiles that had been disabled in our incident. And he went down to do a startup procedure using his manual, his tech order. And halfway through it, he was asked by the topside guard to come up, and they saw the topside guard showed him a ball of light, orange ball of light that was hovering over the facility. He was frightened. They were both frightened, but the maintenance man felt he had to go back down into the missile maintenance bay and continue his checklist to get the missile back up on alert. He told the guard to report the light. But while he was down there, this object was overhead. He would go through his checklist, and when he got to a particular point, the missile shut down again. Now, he couldn't understand it, but he kept doing this while this object was still overhead. And each time he got to a particular point in the checklist, the missile would shut down again. This object was essentially telling him that they knew exactly how our systems worked down to the, you know, the
exactly down to the last diode. Listen, Robert, I got to break away. Richard in Palm Desert, thank you so much for checking in with that story. More of our conversation with Robert Salas, the Pentagon UFO disclosure, UFOs and nukes, and the UFO cabal. When Coast to Coast AM continues, here's the Moody Blues taking us into the break with Ride My Seesaw on Coast to Coast AM. We'll get back to our conversation with Robert Salas, former U.S. Air Force, former FAA official, talking UFOs and nukes and the Pentagon UFO program. Before that, I just mentioned about George Norrie Live landing in Salt Lake City. Well, he's also coming to Scottsdale, Arizona at the Virginia G. Piper Theater. That's in Scottsdale, Saturday, April the 21st, 5 to 8 p.m., and he's got quite a cast with him. Spirit Traveler, Sonia Grace, astronomer and master of all things space, Dr. Sky. That's Steve Cates. We'll end the evening with a UFO roundtable featuring some of the most respected people in ufology today. Dr. Lynn Kitai, of course, from the Phoenix Lights incident. Melinda Leslie, an area talking alien experiences. Travis Walton, John D'Souza. George will also sing a few songs with a live band, and you can take part in a Q&A with each guest. Again, don't miss out. Tickets are going to go fast. You can call the box office at 480-499-8587. 480-499-8587. You can also get online tickets at scottsdalearts.org. scottsdalearts.org. Don't forget the meet and greet following the show. All right, I want to share this story with you. It's just so wild. I got to tell you about this. Greg Bishop, our webmaster tonight, has posted this in the news section up at the website, coasttocoastam.com. Now get this. This is in Newsweek magazine. And there's this Australian lawyer by the name of Bob Gosford. He's a bird lover, and he stumbled on an odd quest one day when he read an account of an indigenous Australian who watched a hawk apparently use a burning twig to deliberately spread fire. Gosford was so fascinated by this, he wondered whether others had seen the same phenomenon, and he and his co-authors have now tracked down 20 more examples that they share in a recent paper published in the Journal of Ethnobiology. The paper comes in response to skepticism about the behavior. Gofford and his co-authors found evidence that this behavior, again, birds of prey, essentially firebombing the countryside in Australia, this behavior was well known to indigenous cultures and to firefighters. They believe these raptors are spreading fires in order to scare prey out of hiding and make it easier to catch dinner. The birds in question are black kites, whistling kites, and brown falcons, all birds of prey found in Australia. There you go. So consider this fair warning. Don't let your budgie play with matches. Back to my conversation with Robert Salas and your phone calls when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. Robert Salas stays with us. Robert, do you foresee any circumstance in which it would be necessary in your mind for U.S. Military personnel to disregard their oath of confidentiality and simply come forward and talk about what they've seen regarding UFO incursions, whether we're talking about nuclear bases or otherwise?
Well, funny you should ask. We just saw this movie, The Post, where people did come forward and release classified information, and it was judged by the Supreme Court that the government really didn't have a right to keep this from the public. And I think the UFO question is kind of in that ballpark, that it is such a profound thing, this phenomenon, and that could impact all of us, that I'm not trying to encourage anybody.
No, and I'm not suggesting that you are. No.
Information to come forward, but I can see a justification for it. Yeah.
Jason is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Jason, good morning, and welcome to Coast AM.
How you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah. I was active Army back when I was 17. I signed in, but I was 14 Tango, and the Patriot missile truck driver, and worked on the truck and everything. But back then, system we had, it shot I think 4 missiles, and we heard rumors about the ones that could shoot up to 16 were coming out. I don't know. I mean, the Air Force, I'm not as smart as them guys, but they might have technology 20, 30 years ahead of time that they're working on, that they're just fooling around, messing around the civilians and Army people and Air Force. And, who knows what you're looking at? That was a thought that I had on the subject.
It's an interesting thought, Jason. It's certainly one that's crossed my mind. But then the question is, why would the Pentagon be spending even a paltry sum of $22 million to study their own people?
Well, I have another idea on the subject. If it's not that, there is another option. I mean, I can give you my opinion on it if you'd like.
We are all ears, Jason. Yes.
All right. It's either the military is ahead of time and they got stuff that they're not telling people about, or I don't believe in aliens and all that stuff. But I do believe, and I'm not preaching or anything like that. I'm not no evangelist, but I do believe that the devil is a good artist with confusion, and he does all kinds of things to make men believe all sorts of different things. You know, I mean, who knows what he does? Who knows what God allows him to do? I don't know if you're a Christian or not, but if you believe in God, there's a devil out there, and he can do a bunch of crazy stuff, and that's what I think it is. If it's not the military, it's people seeing demons fooling around like little kids, you know, confusing people. That's what I think it is.
Well, Jason, you know, one man's extraterrestrial is another man's interdimensional, and we might be talking about the same thing here.
I've listened to the program before on that. That's what I think they are. I mean, it's just, he likes to, you know, the Trinity has been found all over the earth, South America, Egypt, everywhere. And I don't believe in Catholicism, but I believe the Trinity thing is kind of messed up. But anyway, the point is, it's been all over the earth, and how did that happen? I mean, same thing with seeing aliens. It's happened all over the earth. The devil's a good, he likes to confuse men. He thinks of us as dumb animals, and he wants to confuse us. And that's what I think.
I think it's a perfectly legitimate line of inquiry, albeit it's not one that necessarily flies with the majority of the UFO community. It happens to be one that I give strong credence to. Let's get Robert in here.
I have no comment, really. I know there is that line of thought that these so-called aliens or extraterrestrials are somehow devil inspired, but I just hadn't considered that. Let's just put it that way.
Well, or if we're talking interdimensional, and if you want to use the term angelic realm, we could be talking about both sides. We could be talking about fallen angels and the good kind, the good angels. Because there does seem to be that dichotomy, particularly with alien abduction, and you've had an experience, Robert, where some have had a hellacious experience, and others have had a wonderful life-affirming experience. So who knows? Maybe we're dealing with fallen angels and the messengers of God. I mean, I don't know why that's necessarily such a stretch, but those are sort of the two schools out there. And Jason, we thank you for your call. Let's say hi to a wildcard line caller. Mike is in Houston, Texas. Mike, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, Richard, how you doing? I love your work. I enjoy it when you sit in, and I especially love your bumper music. It's always excellent.
Appreciate that.
That monkey's tune was especially good to hear. Robert, I appreciate your service to our country and your courage to speak out and write your book and talk about this issue. Let me say something about the last caller. I did see the movie that came out on Thursday, and it was from a Christian perspective. I am a Christian, but it left too many questions unanswered, and so I was a little disappointed in it. But here's my take on it. First of all, my first question is, Robert, how do you think they know so much about our technology? Now, I realize that they're an advanced civilization, you know, ET, and that they probably have advanced scanning systems, but how is it that they know so much about our missile technology and are able to access it? And do you think they're able to read the minds of our military people or scientists and able to gather information that way or through abduction? And also, do you have any thoughts on whether or not the DOD Pentagon have looked into where, why they're so concerned about us and our planet, out of all the planets in our galaxy. Is it possible that they cohabitate this planet and they have bases here? And has any investigation gone into looking to whether or not, because I know that USOs have been seen off of California and the Catalina Islands there. There's been craft seen around the tops of volcanoes. There's speculation about possible bases on the moon as well as Mars. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts about whether or not they've investigated whether ET is cohabitating this planet with us. And,
all right, Mike. There's about 10 questions in there. All of them great. Let's start with the. Let's start with the. How do they know so much about our technology?
Let me just start with the bases, because I think there's ample evidence that yes, indeed, they do have bases on the planet underwater. There has been a couple of very significant incidents where UFOs have been seen underwater and people reporting that there are bases under there. Also, many reports of ET craft or UFOs having bases within volcanoes or within mountains. And again, I've traveled through many places in the world, and I've heard many stories to that effect. So, yes, I think they do have bases here. Going to the what was the other part of the question?
He wanted to know how they know so much about our technology, and can they read minds?
On that aspect, he did mention the idea that they could read our minds, and again, there's ample evidence from abductees, from experiences, that they do indeed read our minds. They communicate telepathically, so they could very well have either through abductions or other means read the minds of our scientists, people who are engineers who are working on these weapon systems. They have that capability, so I think that's how they may have gleaned our technology. What was the other question?
There were quite a few of them, Mike. Was there one more? You could just give us your top question that you'd like Robert to answer. Make it a short one.
I think Robert pretty much covered it there.
Excellent. All right.
And he hit on some points that I've thought about, and particularly the moon. I'm wondering what the Chinese and the Russians might be looking for on the moon, as well as our own, return to the moon. So there's, been a lot of rumors about what our astronauts saw up there during the Apollo missions.
Yeah, you may know or you may not know that one of the witnesses in 2001, when we spoke at the National Press Club, was with NASA. And she was a photo analyst who had seen structures on the moon in some of the photos taken by NASA. There's a data point for you right there.
Was she asked to airbrush them out?
I think so. I believe so. If you get a hold of the testimonies, I know Greer put out a book of the testimonials of the witnesses. I forget her name offhand, I'm sorry, but she did work for NASA. I remember her story of seeing these photos of structures on the moon.
All right, let's see if we can squeeze in one more call. We go to the first-time caller line. James is in Boston. James, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hello, how are you, Michael?
It's Richard and Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I don't have a question. It's more of an observation. I believe that art imitates life. And if you've ever watched, a Star Trek program, they have a prime directive not to interfere with another species. You mentioned Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, why wouldn't they have stopped something like that? It's just my opinion. Like I said, art imitates life. And who knows, you know, maybe people in Hollywood have more access to this stuff than us, or they've spoken to people. Maybe it's just the fact that they can't interfere with us. I mean, they can observe us, but not interfere.
All right, James, good point. Your thoughts, Robert, on that?
I tend to agree that somehow the ETs have decided not to interfere too much with what we're doing. They want to see us evolve and to a higher level of consciousness so that we take care of important issues like nuclear weapons on our own without their help. They want to see us get there on our own.
All right, James, thank you for that. Let me ask you, Robert, that's why we have you on the program. As we wind things down here, Robert, would you care to give maybe a nudge or a suggestion or an assignment to U.S. military personnel and how they might be able to push this needle forward on UFO disclosure?
We have, myself and others, have talked to military witnesses and held their identities secret. So if any of them want to contact me, I certainly would talk to them and hold their identities secret, because I understand what's involved. It's very serious to have classified information and release it to the public. But I guess they should research the existing incidents involving military facilities and understand what's happened in the past. Other people have come forward. Many people have come forward, actually, military people, and discussed their experiences with UFOs. So if they can, possibly, I would encourage them to come forward and increase the volume of information that we have on this subject.
Can they get a hold of you at spiralgalaxy.org, Robert?
No, I don't think that's a good way to get a hold of me. You can contact me on Facebook. I've got a site there, and also I'll give you my email address. It's rsolis15@roadrunner.com if they want to contact me. rsolis15@roadrunner.com.
rsolis, S-A-L-A-S, 15 at roadrunner.com.
That's right.
Bob, thank you so much for this. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Richard. I appreciate it. Great talking to you again. Stay warm up there.
No problem. Thank you so much. New York Times, the ball is in your court. All right, we have British psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker standing by. In the meantime, here's Clarence Carter taking us into the break with Snatching It Back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y-R-E-T-T. That's Eddie Floyd, knock on wood, in case you're keeping score at home. A team of researchers with members from several institutions in France has conducted a study regarding sleep talking and has found that most sleep talking is not only negative in nature but involves a large amount of swearing. In their paper published in the journal Sleep, the group described... Where were they going to publish it? Field and Stream? The group describes their study, which involved watching and recording hundreds of volunteers as they slept. In analyzing the data from 230 volunteers who agreed to spend two nights sleeping in the lab, the researchers found that sleep talking, volunteers said the word no four times as often as when they were awake. And they also found that the F word was spoken much more commonly than while awake, on average 800 times as often. And this news bulletin just in, still no cure for cancer. Startling accurate predictions. televised seances that were banned in Britain, attempted communication with the late Diana Spencer, and a 5,000-year-old oracle from India that revealed the story of his life with 100% accuracy. My conversation with psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker is next on Coast to Coast AM. Craig Hamilton Parker's career as a psychic medium has been closely associated with his family and wife, Jane. Soon after they met, Craig gave up his career as chief executive for an advertising agency, and Jane her job as a psychiatric nurse, to pursue a career as mediums. To earn a living, they gave private readings, and Craig wrote psychic news columns and a number of books for the U.S. publisher Sterling. Craig Hamilton Parker has also written extensively about dream interpretation. His book, The Hidden Meaning of Dreams, became a bestseller, and he has hosted the U.S. TV show Nightmares Decoded. Craig and his wife now spend their time spreading their messages of mystical awareness and survival of death. Craig Hamilton Parker, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
First of all, I want to commend you. You and I have talked about this before, but you have one of the great website domains, psychics.co.uk. How did you manage to grab hold of getting a one-word domain is extremely difficult. Psychics.co.uk.
Yeah, well, psychics.co.uk was available at the time because I was very early onto the internet. I could have chosen quite a few domains, actually, a lot of single names. If only I'd known at that time the extent that the internet would take in our lives, you know. So, yeah, I was very lucky to get that. And, of course, it stayed with me. And I built on there now. I put all my articles on there, and we have a community on there, chat rooms and so forth. So it's and forums. So it's a great place where people can come together. And it's been, you know, important to me and was my first way of reaching out to the world, really, through other than just in the UK.
Right. Well, you got in on the ground floor with the website, psychics.co.uk. That's got to be worth a fortune. I want to talk about your TV show, Psychic Family. I've read sort of the, you know, blurbs about it, and they said the family that's so psychic, even the dog is psychic. Well, I always thought all dogs were psychic, but I mean, do you have a dog, and is it psychic? Is he or she psychic?
Well, the dog's gone to the spirit world now. We've got cats at the moment, but certainly our dog William. He was my nemesis in many ways. He was here before I met Jane, and he used to growl when I came into the room. But he had a real it's a funny thing, you know, when psychic people come together, because Jane and myself are both mediums, we call ourselves here in the UK, able to communicate with the spirit world, so, which is a psychic type gift. And it kind of rubs off, I think, on each other. I mean, it rubs off on the children. It rubs off on the animals around us. William, the dog, used to sit at, when my wife Jane was doing a reading, for example, and someone was in distress, he kind of knew straight away if there was a real problem. And sometimes, and the cats do it now too, would sit outside the door outside when the consultation's going on, you know, and sort of kind of treat the person with almost a form of compassion. I'm sure animals are very, and children, are very sensitive to many things that as adults we lose.
Oh, 100%. Just a quick story on that note. My mother-in-law was visiting my brother-in-law and his lovely bride over the Christmas break. They have a little poodle named Louie, adorable. But my mother-in-law has had some pain. And she's one of those people that she never complains, and she has this pain. It was on her right leg, and the dog knew immediately. He went over and put his head down on her sort of on her right thigh in her lap, and was licking her right leg. They know.
And also my understanding with the way it works with survival after death with animals is that animals retain their sense of identity after death as we do as humans. And they become spirits too. And I think the contact with human love in earthly life gives them a sense of I-ness, a sense of personal existence, which they wouldn't get as wild animals. And in many ways, I think the fact that animals interconnect with us with human life in this world actually makes them continue as a soul in the next life. It's like we rub off on them, that sense of I that we have as humans begins to emerge in the animal kingdom.
I want to talk about some of your predictions. And I mentioned this to you before, and that is one of the things that you do that I have to commend you on is when you get something wrong, you call yourself out on it. You don't try and bury it or avoid it or just kind of skip over it. You say, you know what? That one, I blew it. I didn't get that one, but, you know, and then you'll list something else that you did get, but you do mention the ones that you get wrong. And I find that very commendable, and it gives you more credibility.
Well, we have to do that. It's otherwise, what's the point, you know? Because when it's like sometimes we're fallible as psychics, and as just as we are as people, you know, we get some things right, we get some things wrong. But when you look at the bigger picture and you look at it as the overall view of it, you can see that people that have a genuine gift get a far higher percentage right than they would by chance. But they do get insights sometimes that are so out of the ordinary that it's more than just a hit. It's something, well, how could you possibly have known that, you know? And that's so we have to call ourselves out if we're getting something wrong, and we do. Sometimes all of the psychic people do. Nostradamus must have got stuff wrong too, you know. But if we get certain things that stand out like real beacons, then that should make us think something about, you know, is the future, is it possible to see the future?
Well, two of the sterling examples that you called, we have to talk about. One is Brexit. How soon did you call the Brexit vote? Because everybody, all the major news outlets, right up until even after the polls closed, were saying it was going to be a no to Brexit by, you know, as many as 10 points in some cases. But you went out on a limb and said, no, it's going to be a yes for Brexit. How soon did you know?
Well, really, right the way through, right from the start, my immediate feeling was that Brexit was going to happen, even though everybody took it for granted that it wouldn't. I mean, here in the UK, it was almost as if the Prime Minister at the time, he just didn't care about even put an effort into it. It seemed like it was a done thing. Everybody assumed nobody would possibly vote for us to get out of Europe. And I had a very strong feeling from a long time before, because in my predictions, I think right back in 2004, I was saying that eventually Britain's going to leave Europe. And when it did come around, I felt right the way through. And even though people were saying, because I published my predictions on my website, and you can comment on there, and people are saying, oh, now, ha, 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 you know, can you really feel Brexit's going to happen after all this? You know, you don't stand a chance for it to happen. And I felt really strong that it would, and it was a shock. Everybody here and around the world flabbergasted that Brexit happened. And I think when you do psychic predictions, you know, you've got to give what you see. You can't just go be an influence because opinion polls have changed or so forth. You have to go with what your gut feeling is. And I stuck with it. And that's, yes, it happened. You know?
And the other was the election of President Trump. How soon did you call that?
Well, I called it just before he stood. So I was kind of shocked that what I'd seen had happened. And when I felt Trump, I felt Trump would be president, right from the very beginning, and stuck with that despite what people are saying. I mean, everybody says, "Ah, oh, no, Trump, no, he doesn't stand a chance," you know. So right from the start, I felt, yes, this man is going to be there. It's funny, you get a feeling about things. I often get, you know, I have dreams. I get senses through my connection with these Indian oracles, which we'll talk about later, I think, have kind of heightened my understanding that the future can be predicted. I never thought it could. You know, it used to always go against the grain with me to think that the future could be predicted, because it kind of knocks free will out of the equation when we do that. But no, I saw Trump, and I feel, you know, and I've made a lot of predictions about Donald Trump over the time. And he was there. No, despite what people said, I thought he was going to be president, and he was, of course.
And you called that even before he announced his candidacy?
Yes, I was saying something. The actual details were saying, I was saying something about a TV personality is going to be is going to stand for president. And then when I saw it was Trump, that's it. That's what I'm seeing.
Right. And for the skeptics out there, I mean, you document these and some of them you post on YouTube. Are the Brexit and the Trump predictions part of your 2015 predictions on YouTube?
Not sure if there's a YouTube one for that, but they're certainly all over the website. And I obviously date it so people can see the datings of things on there. But yes, on the YouTube, there's 2015, 16, and 17 out there, I think.
Mm. I want to get into, after-death communication with you. But one of the things I thought was incredibly courageous of you to do was to take on noted atheist Richard Dawkins in a debate. How did that go? And this was televised. How did that go?
It was. And actually, you know, I know everybody calls him Darwin's Rottweiler and so forth. And he's one of the most skeptical men about this type of thing there is. But I actually, firstly, I liked the man a great deal because my thought is, you know, this man is not, he's not doing this. He's doing this because he genuinely believes in this objective world as the only reality. And yeah, we had a very good debate. They filmed, first of all, me giving a demonstration of mediumship at a spiritualist church in England. And I was a little bit upset with the fact they didn't show the full thing because people were, for example, I come to one woman there and I said to her, you got the tar mills. What's this about tar mills and Doncaster or something like that, I said to her. Well, apparently the tar mills is what they used to call the sweet factory down the road. And when they interviewed her, they paid no attention to that whatsoever. And all those little things that really clinch it to prove that how on earth could you know something so specific which about something about the complete other end of the country, which was just a local thing for that woman. There was lots of things like that. But then the actual debate itself, I felt was pretty good because I actually agree with Dawkins on a lot of things. I believe that we can't, well, that word believe, I think belief is sometimes a bit dangerous. We must trust experience and we must trust empirical facts as well. But so I'm with him on the fact that, you know, just because, you know, we believe there's a chocolate teapot going around the earth doesn't mean it exists. But then I disagree with him fundamentally about many of the ways that science tries to address our reason for being here. You know, the whole concept of consciousness we got into and argued about, the whole idea of the continuation of the soul, the existence of telepathy, and also about, you know, evolution itself, because, you know, he talks so much about Darwin, but we forget that William Crookes and others, and that Darwin was not the first person to come up with the idea of evolution. It was, in fact, a spiritualist that came up with the idea of evolution.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then the spiritualist discussed it with Darwin, and then Darwin then thought, I must publish it. I must publish that. Oh, I've forgotten his name. Famous person. What a nuisance.
It'll come to you. It'll come to you. So Darwin was sort of like the Edison of his time. He took other people's ideas.
Well, it's funny. A lot of great ideas kind of emerge simultaneously in the world. And although Darwin had already started writing his ideas about evolution, it was... But I've forgotten the name of the person. What annoying! It was when they. It was only when he met the spiritualist that it triggered that I must publish.
Interesting. I'll tell you a little hint. When I forget something, if I squint my eyes and I look up into the right top hand corner of the room, it usually comes to me for some reason. I don't know why. Craig Hamilton Parker is with us. Did you score any points? I mean, did with Dawkins, or did? Let me put it this way: Did he concede any points that you made?
Well, I think with him, you can only ever get a stalemate. I don't think you can ever win or lose because he's looking at the whole idea of spirituality from a different sense. He believes it's all belief systems. I believe that the fact is that, you know, the objective world is not the only reality. That we have a whole different reality, an inner reality, a world of consciousness. And I say that that consciousness can survive physical death, that the human apparatus does not generate consciousness, but is built more like a television that transmits consciousness into this world. So, you know, two completely different standpoints.
What would be your, we're heading into a break here. We've got about 3.5 minutes. What would be your best piece of evidence for life after death communication, either just to the general public or to Dawkins?
Well, I don't think you can say, you can't put your finger on one particular thing and say that is the final answer. Although some great experiments were done, such as things such as the cross correspondence that people could look up on the internet and things like that, where groups of people around the world brought information together separately. But you have to take the information as a whole. It's more like putting a case in a court of law. It's not just the one specific fact that makes it work. It's by bringing all the evidence together, the evidence about what comes through people like me and mediums, but also through things such as near-death experiences, people's experiences in meeting the dead in dreams, children's experiences, things like this. That there's also, when you add all the evidence together that we have accumulated for life after death, then we find that there is, you know, when the evidence is taken as a whole, there is such empirical proof that it's definitely the case. It's proven through all the facts together.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about this seance that you were involved with that was televised to communicate with Lady Di, Princess Diana. But first of all, why was that banned in Britain?
Well, it was very sensitive at the time because it was... the royal family, I don't think, liked the idea. So, unfortunately, the objective of what we wanted to do was to give proof that Diana survived. That's all we wanted to do. As spiritualists, we felt we were asked to do this, and we thought, well, this would be something that could, you know, Diana believed in life after death, and, you know, we felt she could communicate. So, there are strict rules in the UK about transmitting anything to do with mediumship. It's very controlled from the earlier days by strong Christian groups that don't like mediumship. It's become much easier nowadays, but at the time, I think a lot of those laws kicked in. In America, there was also, it was a bit too contentious, I think, for the mainstream programs, and in the end, it had to go on pay-per-view. But it certainly caused a stir worldwide. And, yes, it was quite a story.
Yeah, it was seen like by something like, was it, it was over 30 million viewers, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and more. I mean, goodness knows how many have seen it since, because, I mean, it's been streamed again recently, I believe, in America. And, yeah, I think, you know, with this type of thing, it's such a contentious subject because people saw Diana as almost a goddess, you know. She represented to people something that seemed to be every woman's plight, you know.
Certainly, certainly she was. Listen, Craig, we'll take a time out. We'll come back. We'll talk about the seance, and then we'll get into this remarkable mystical journey to India and the Oracle. You'll tell us all about that. Craig Hamilton Parker on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back. And if you like what you're hearing tonight, this morning, I invite you to check out my weekly syndicated radio show, The Conspiracy Show, airs Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio, AM 740, 96.7 FM. And for more information and a list of affiliates, you can go to my website, strangeplanet.ca. And I also want to tell you about my brand new podcast. It just launched early December. It's called Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can check it out and subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com or just go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio. It's everywhere. All right, when we come back, more of my conversation with Craig Hamilton Parker as we discuss his seance to communicate with Princess Diana on the other side and the remarkable story of the Knotty Leaf Oracle right here on Coast to Coast AM. Psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker is with us. He's joining us live from Great Britain. You were asked by American television producers to conduct this live seance to make contact with the spirit of the late Diana Spencer, Lady Di. But they tried to set you up a little bit, didn't they?
Yes. Just before I go on, that was Alfred Russel Wallace. That was the person that invented evolution before Darwin, from the last little section. But now, yes, it would kind of set up a little bit, because there were people, for example, sat around the seance table when we actually did the final connections with Diana, who didn't even know Diana. And that was on Jane's readings, and she actually picked up on that person and knew, said, "No, you didn't even know Diana," which kind of threw them a bit, because now when you communicate with somebody like Princess Diana, of course there's so many reasons people could argue that it's not a communication, because there's so much in the press, there's so much you could look up. So we had to have people around the table that we first of all didn't know anything about and couldn't tell research or know anything about them whatsoever. And those people also had to actually know Diana really well. These were friends and confidants of Diana's. So they could tell us, they knew personal information with Diana that nobody else would know about.
And who chose the participants, Craig? Was it you or the producers?
We had nothing to do with the choice. We didn't know who was going to be at our table until we actually sat down minutes before. So we were blindfolded. We were kept in another area of the building. And then we were kept separated. So Jane and I couldn't communicate with each other. Jane did the first set of readings. I did the second set of readings. And then so nothing was done beforehand, so that we had no idea who it was going to be.
And so, again, they planted some people to try and, I guess, discredit you, that knew nothing about Diana. They didn't know her. And Jane, in particular, your wife, was able to suss them out immediately.
Yes, indeed she did. In fact, this was all overseen by someone that came from the university who was an arch skeptic, to make sure that, you know, there could be no cheating from the producer's side either. And, first thing she did is picked up. She had a number of people around her table. First thing she said is, "No, you didn't even know Diana. I don't know what you're sat here for." You know, which completely threw away their agenda of trying to trick her.
I guess it would.
And then at the same time, of course, then we both gave connections to Diana to each of the people around the table. And in Jane's sessions, for example, she knew that one of the women there worked with AIDS and had AIDS, and was able to tell her things about all the work she'd done with Diana's charity, and lots and lots and lots of little details that really blew the minds of these people that were sat there, things that nobody else knew. And the same for myself. I mean, I gave my consultations to the people around the table. And again, it's nerve-wracking, I tell you, because, you're being told to do something because you don't know at all if you're going to get anything until you sit down. That's the way mediumship works. You kind of don't even know if you're tuned in until you open your mouth, I find. That's how it works with me.
Right. And people are watching you, waiting for you to fail. It's almost like watching figure skating, where people are waiting for the person, you know, to fall.
Yeah, even the people filming it in some respects, you know. I mean, because, you know, and my attitude is, if I can't get anything, well, I'm not going to make it up. I'll just have to say, sorry, I look an idiot. I'll be an idiot to the world. I'm not connected, you know. So, and I warned them at this, you know, that, you know, this is how the way we have to work. You know, we're not going to do anything that's not true. And also, anything we did for this too, I have to add, we did this purely because we wanted to do it to help the spiritual cause, as it were. We didn't take any money for this, and all funds were given to a Diana Trust. So Jane were doing it purely to prove life after death.
And how quickly or how long did it take for the spirit of Diana to come to you?
Well, she was with us before, in a way, because we went around Paris first of all, and we're picking up on information in Paris. But you're picking more up on the places and the feelings of the places. It was only when you sat down and started giving the readings for the people sat next to that with us on the table, that the information started to really flow. I think for me, the strongest point came when, you know, even the people sat there, yeah, and then you hit something that is really important. And I think the one that really changed people's thinking was when I said to the lady who, Louise, I think her name was, who had been Diana's secretary for some years, I said to her, you used to keep in your pocket special sweets for Princess Diana, because she was always, you know, she was bulimic and always on a diet, but you used to carry these sweets with you, and these were specifically called pear drops. Now, that's a, I don't know if you have those in America as well.
I'm not familiar.
But they're a specific form of sweets that they have here in the UK. And she was blown away because she said, God, how did you know I kept pear drops? I used to always keep a packet of pear drops in my pocket. And when Diana used to come up to me, she said, have you got a pear drop? You know? And it was little things like this, you know? And it was, and I used, and to one of the other men, I said there, he'd been in charge of something. I said, in Windsor Castle with Diana, you and Diana used to go and fry eggs in the small rooms because she always fancied an egg sandwich, right? And there was things like that that, you know, now there's no way that you could look that sort of stuff up. There's
no, these
way
are not people in the public eye.
That appeal to anybody. Sorry?
Right. I said these are not people that were in the public eye. She didn't publish a tell-all book.
No, there were none of these people I'd ever seen before. I mean, there were things like there was a correspondent there that must have been in the public eye, but I'd never heard of him before. I didn't know Diana's personal secretary, of course. She's not a face that you would have seen on the...
Right. So, and when you revealed that information, she must have let out a gasp.
Off her chair, and I think everybody did there too, because, you know, even, you know, these, we're not dealing here with people that are spiritualists or open-minded to it really completely, because they're coming from journalistic backgrounds, they're coming from charity backgrounds. There was people there from a musician and things like this, and you know, they're all coming, they weren't people like perhaps like listening to this show that would be open and thinking about these things all the time. These were people that were a little bit armoured.
Sure.
Quite a battle, I tell you, in some ways. So you have to give what we mediums call evidence of survival. You have to give these evidential facts that nobody else could know.
So you mentioned the fried egg sandwiches and the pear drops. Was there maybe one more specific example that you could give? Do you recall?
Let's think. Well, I mentioned the name of the lullaby that one of them had written there for Diana. I mentioned things such as the stories of Windsor Castle and about how she tripped on the stair and things like those. There was lots of small things that, taken together, add up to give really good proof of life after death. And that was our objective. You see, mediums, they don't, we're not really a telephone line to the spirit world. We pick things up through our unconscious mind. It's more like picking up things from a dream, where you get feelings, you get thoughts, you get images, you get impressions, you get flashes of events that happened. And that it's not like some Diana saying, hey, Craig, our name's so-and-so, and this, like this, 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 this. Sometimes we get this, what we call a clairaudience. But often it's little bits and pieces that come together that make up, that in themselves seem insignificant, but together, taken as a whole, become quite good, strong, evidential proof that life continues.
So when you receive messages from Princess Diana, you're saying it's all on sort of the unconscious or subconscious level. In other words, you don't hear her voice, you don't see an apparition.
Well, you get about you hear the voice, you sense the person, you get a feeling of their personality. It's a blending of thoughts. That's how mediumship works. It's
right.
It's like a form of telepathy in a way, except it's not a telepathy with someone that sat in front of you. It's telepathy with someone in the spirit world. Their thoughts overlay the medium's thoughts, and my job is to push out what appear to be my thoughts and focus what appear to be thoughts coming in from outside of myself.
So obviously, the million-dollar question, the $64 million question everyone wanted answered was Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, were they murdered? And what did you find out?
Well, this was the difficult one, because she was absolutely adamant. You know, once we made the connection, once we knew that we had Diana, once we had a lot of proof and the people around the table all accepted that it was Diana communicating, then I could ask Diana a question. Were you murdered? You know? And the answer came back a resounding no. Now, that is not what people want to hear, because people that are interested in all this thing, to be honest, want to hear all sorts of conspiracies, want to hear all the things about, you know, did she, was she killed in the ambulance, was she pregnant, was all the rest of all those hundreds and hundreds of questions that come up, you know, what was that flashing light in the tunnel and everything. And her answer to me was, no, it was an accident. We were being chased and the car went off the road. It was as simple as that, and we hit the column, you know. And, you know, and I thought, God, blimey, I don't want to say that, but that's what I had to say.
Right. The producers were not interested in hearing that, probably.
No. And program makers, of course, want to get a headline. But that was the feeling we had. It was an unfortunate accident. Now, that doesn't mean to say that there weren't other things going on around Diana. Now, I did another reading some years before. That's kind of how this came up, because I gave a reading to a woman that was one of her, she used to do the colonic irrigation for Diana, and Diana used to go to her all the time. And I gave a message from Diana to her unexpectedly in a reading, and I didn't know it was Diana at the time. I said she gave you a Romanov, something owned by the Romanovs, a little thing. And she actually brought a photograph out of the object that Diana had given her. And in that, she said to me afterwards, Diana was absolutely terrified that she was going to be murdered. She said to me,
yes,
you know, horrified, because the Secret Service were following her every step of the way. But even in that, I didn't feel that early connection with Diana, that a murder had taken place.
Right. She had written letters to Scotland Yard.
At that time. Sorry?
I said she had, in fact, written letters to Scotland Yard expressing that fear.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Mm. She was obviously horrified and terrified by what was going on around her. But I think maybe they were going to do something like that. But certainly the day it happened under the Alma Bridge, that was a pure accident when that happened. I'm sure a lot of the royal family must have sighed a great sigh of relief initially when they saw Diana out of the picture, you know. And
right,
I'm
right.
sure there were people in the Secret Service who were glad to see her go. But that wasn't them that did it, is the feeling I got from that, which is unfortunate, because I know as soon as I say this, everybody goes up in arms. Oh, but what about this fact? What about that fact? What about that fact? I have to give what I got from that seance. And although I know it goes against the grain with most people, that was what happened, as far as I understand it, from the messages we were given from Princess Diana.
Remarkable. The pear candies, to me, that little detail is just is very impressive. I want to talk about the Nadi Leaf Oracle. Now, you see, this was an education for me, Craig, because I always thought, when I think of an oracle, you know, the Oracle of Delphi, I think of a person. I didn't know that an oracle could be an object. So what is this Nadi Leaf Oracle?
Okay, well, an oracle tells the future, basically. So, yes, an oracle can be a person like Delphi, or can be also like a book like the I Ching that a lot of people may use, or the tarot cards. They can be an oracle. But the Nadi Oracle is something that absolutely blew me away in a way that I've never encountered before. I mean, I'd been looking for this oracle for many years. Now, as you know, at the top of the program, you talked about how I got on the internet very early. And in the days when it was pretty much email and a little bit else, I got in touch with some friends in India. We were talking, and I was saying, can you ever find the Nadi Oracle? And I heard about it, you see. Now, this oracle, allegedly, at the time, it's supposed to be able to tell you everything about your life 100% accurate. And I'd kind of found a few old books about it from the past, of people that had consulted it, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, these things are just beyond belief. You know, the oracle is supposed to be 100% what it said. So I started trying to track it down. This is, like I said, just at the early days of the internet. And I made a friend called Vivek, and we were talking about it a lot. We were both very interested at the time in the Indian holy man called Sai Baba. So we were communicating about a lot of things that were happening at the time about that. Now, then some years later, well, a lot of years later, 2 years ago, I think it might have been now, we connected again through Facebook. And he said, Craig, I found the Nadi Oracle. And I said, oh, what? He said, well, the Nadi Oracle is everywhere in India, actually, Craig. There's Nadis everywhere. But to find the real one is very difficult, because it's like with all of this stuff, you know, you get the real stuff and you get a lot of imposters. And I must warn people, if they want to go out and start hunting for it on the internet, be enormously careful, because most of it out there is absolute trash. But he found...
It's like the knockoff Rolexes in Times Square.
Because you might change your life by it.
But it's why is it called a leaf oracle, Craig? What is it? What does it look like? What is it made out of?
This oracle was written 5,000 years ago by seers that saw the future of any person that will consult it. And it's written on palm leaves. These are sort of like wooden sort of slats, a bit like a Venetian blind where they're tied together by a piece of string through the middle. That's how they used to write the books years ago in India. And it's written in an old form of Tamil. Now, Tamil's the language of southern India. But this is an older, older form of Tamil that you still find on the temples. It was originally translated from Sanskrit into old Tamil and then into Tamil and then retranslated into English for me. And so that's why they're the palm leaves, because they're written on the old palm leaves. Now, when you consult it in two stages. The first stage is to find out your leaf. Now, that sounds... That sounds faint, strange to use the leaves to find a leaf. But there's a number of ways to do that. And some people measure the shadow. But the southern Indian system is to actually take your thumbprint. So I set up a reading to do this on Skype. And all we sent was my thumbprint. Now, this was going to be done over Skype. So I set up a fake Skype account. I set up fake email addresses. I gave fake names. And I wouldn't connect with the guy until the absolute last minute when we arranged the time for the connection to be made. Now, with just my thumbprint and no other knowledge, it was sent through proxy emails and all. There was absolutely no way he could have tracked me down or checked me out on the internet. You know, that's important. And I have to say, this was going on before the times of the internet as well, those earlier stories I'd heard about this. Now, what you do...
Let me just interject here, Craig, because we're coming up on a break, but let me just clarify here. So the person on the other end of Skype, they had in their possession a legitimate Nadi leaf oracle.
Yes. They have the oracle, and this thumbprint will find them my leaf, as it were, my chapter.
All right. We'll find out about your leaf, your chapter in the Nadi leaf oracle. We'll take a time out. David Bowie, Life on Mars, one of the greats, taking us into the break. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. And I will be back here in the Coast to Coast AM air chair again Sunday night into Monday morning. I guess they'll keep dragging me back until I get it right. First hour, Mike Lindell, the inventor of the popular My Pillow, tells his rags to riches story, including... his battle with crack cocaine. Then, former NASA employee, scientist Josiah Zehner. He's the first known person to have edited his own DNA in an effort to make himself superhuman. I look forward with great anticipation to both of those conversations, and I hope you'll be along for the ride. When we come back, more of my conversation with Craig Hamilton Parker, British psychic medium, and we'll continue to delve into this remarkable mystic journey to India and the Nadi Leaf Oracle. Stay tuned right here on Coast to Coast AM. British psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker is with us here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about the Nadi Leaf Oracle. So before the break, Craig, you were explaining that... you had contacted someone who was able to obtain an actual real copy, or not a copy, but an actual Nadi leaf oracle, and that you set this meeting up on Skype. You didn't divulge your real name in order to sort of test the veracity of this leaf oracle. Now, before we went away to break, you were explaining what this oracle works and how... you had to submit your thumbprint. That's how they identify whether or not you have a leaf in the oracle, correct?
Right. All he had is my thumbprint. Nothing else to go on. Okay, so then we decide to connect, and we made the connection to southern India. And Then what happens was you have this pile of, like I said, it's like a Venetian blind, it looks like, of leaves, of wooden sort of leaves from the oracle, made on palm leaves. And he goes through, the thumbprint helps him find your pile, and in that pile is your leaf. So you then have to start the laborious process of going through the leaves to find your leaf. So he look at the first leaf and say, you export precious metals for a living. No. You have just had a hospital operation. No. You have just bought three houses. No. So there are all sort of very specific things. I was thinking, okay, here we go. Is this going to be some sort of form of cold reading? You know, they're going to feed me back information that I say. So I was only going to say yes and no, nothing more. And, of course, there were just weird questions. They were just some bizarre sort of things. And he starts going through these things. There was nothing there that was sort of leading questions or anything. It was just rejecting each leaf as we went through. And then finally he comes to the leaf and says, your first wife's name was Tina. Yes, that's correct. Okay. I thought, well, that's interesting, because first of all, nothing on the internet about that. I don't make any noise about the fact that I've been married before or my first wife's name. And then he looks at the next line. Your present wife's name is Jane. Yes, that's correct. Your mother's name is Ethel. Yes. Your father's name is Dunild. You know, they were saying it in an Indian accent.
Right.
I go, blimey, yes, correct.
And again, we should remind listeners that the person on the other end who has in their possession the leaf oracle, they don't know your real name. They don't know anything about your identity. You've hidden that from them.
Absolutely. Went to extreme lengths to make sure that he could find nothing out about me, right? And then he starts firing off other things about my life. You know, you used to be an artist. Yes, I did. You know, your father used to work in the tax office. Now, that was one that really blew me away, because only I knew that. My brother didn't even know that my dad's first job he had was in the tax office, you know? Mm. Even though I always knew my dad as a teacher and a restaurateur later in his life, but not in the tax office. And he was firing away at things like this and told about things I'd done in my life, books I'd written, and all these things. And he said your brother's name, he said your brother's wife's name, the sister's name, who had children, operations that had been done in people, illnesses that had happened, one thing after another, after another, after another. And we went through all this whole load of things. And then eventually he comes to the things, and your name, which is kind of the conclusion of it, is Craig. I go, yes. And you were born on the 24th of January, 1954. Yes. You were born at 1:30 in the morning. Yes. How on earth did he know that?
I'm not 100% accuracy. 100%.
Not a single question, not a single thing that he said on there was wrong. It was 100% with the weirdest of facts that you couldn't possibly, some of which only I knew, you know?
Well, how many, said, I have to ask you, Craig, how many,
my wife Jane was saying, he must have looked it up. He must have, and he said, no. And then he said, your wife has a rash on her leg at the moment. I said, that's the only thing that's wrong, Jane. She said, and she pulled up her slacks he had on and said, look at that, I'm covered in a rash. I didn't even know that, you know?
Right. Now, how many pages are in this oracle?
Well, there's 7 pages for each person. There's sections called candams, but it's written in tiny, tiny little Tamil writing, and you can access more. And actually, the funny thing is, the oracle, you see, I didn't just trust this, you see, before the readers start saying, oh, there must be a con here somewhere. I saw 2 more readers through my original contact, and they all said the same thing. And then I met a professor who had been studying this in Denmark for years, and he'd done 30 years of research into this. And I made contact with him and asked him what he said, what he thought. And he said, well, let me see if I can find you an oracle. And he put me in touch with 2 more who all said the same thing. In slightly different ways, worded slightly differently, because it would be, some of them were like, it was done as a conversation between Shiva and Pravati and things like this. But all the same information was there and more. And this is the leaf. That finds my leaf. That's just the beginning.
Right. But I have so many questions about this. Again, it's the Nadi Leaf Oracle, NAADI, the Nadi Leaf Oracle. How come you get 7 pages in the Oracle? What's so special about you, Craig?
Well, the Oracle is supposed to be there for every person that consults it. Not every person in the world, every person that consults, or every person that ever actually finds it and will find the Oracle, there's a page for it. And one of the meanings of the word Nadi is to seek. So you have to seek this oracle. It's not something you can just sort of say, oh, give us a reading. You have to find your oracle. You have to find your leaf.
So if I were to seek the Nadi oracle and I had someone on the other end, there would be guaranteed 7 pages about me or not necessarily
I'm
so?
I'm saying I believe the 7 for each person, because what happens is the oracle starts to change over a period of time. You see, it makes a prediction. Now, the second section of looking at the Oracle, because we did as a second section, it tells you what will happen in your life, good and bad. And here's the rub. It even tells you the day you will die. So you've got to be prepared to take on some pretty heavy stuff. It tells you incurable illnesses and things like this. You know? Now, once you're armed with this information, you know, you can see what it, for me, it was a revelation because it showed me exactly what I should be doing in my life. I was at a real crossroads at the time. I'd had a lot of problems with Google messing up my website for me and pulling me off the search results. I just finished. I thought I'd had enough of writing at that particular time. And I was beginning to think, what do I do with my life? How's the best way I can work with this mediumship and so forth so it can be really help people, you know, and it gave me all that, and it showed me everything I should do and how I could work. And the most important thing for me, it told me that I could work as a charitable trust. And I thought, yes, I'm going to work for charity with this. You know, I'm going to do this just to help people, and we're going to put all this money and do some good with it and feed people in India, right, and so on. Another thing, I can tell you about that later.
So it tells you your destiny.
But it told me my destiny, and it gave me what they call remedies. Ways you can change the karma. You see, the Indian idea is that it tells you about your past lives. So it revealed my past lives, good and bad. And in those past lives, it said, you did this and you did that. And you did this and I did good things and I did negative things. And it said, to get rid of this negative karma, you have to do these spiritual remedies. Now, some of those I could do in the UK. But some of them meant I had to go to India to do this, because I had to go to specific temples. I had to meet special holy men. I had to do special fire rituals and things like this that would clear the negative energy. Now, I'm not from a Hindu background or anything like that. But when you get such specific information, I think, my God, I'm going to go and do these remedies. What have I got to lose? You know.
Well, not to would be to deny your destiny and might be inviting bad karma, I would think.
Well, yeah, possibly, yes. I mean, it would probably work out as it's been told. But you can avoid that. You can increase the good and you can negate the bad by doing the rituals. And those, one of the things those rituals included, which I really liked the idea of, is to do real charitable work. So one of the things I had to do was to buy someone in India a cow and a calf and to feed people in mental asylums, okay? Mm-hmm. So it was all written down there. So I decided I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to do these remedies. And I booked a flight to India to go into the middle of India where I knew nobody to do these oracles and to see if I could somehow do these rituals.
Do you have to do the journey alone?
Well, initially that's what it seemed to be. But then my friend from Denmark said, well, I can put you in touch with 2 Nadi readers there who will take you around and help you do that. And they'll take you to all the places you need to go in India and help you find it where you can show you how to do the rituals. Brilliant. Could do that. And I thought, this is just too good an adventure. This is Indiana Jones, you know. I'm going off to do something. And I wish someone would come with me. And my friend Louis Frost is a film producer. He only does small films, but, you know, guerrilla sort of film type things. And I said, Louis, do you have a cameraman that could come with me? Do you think we could film this? And he said, yeah, well, I'll see what I can do. And we found a cameraman, a young fella, you know, got on well with him immediately. I said, come with me, and let's see if we can film it. And he got a high-quality camera, Red, they call it.
The Red camera, that's the best, yeah.
Real good one, right? And some other ones for doing the faster scenes. And said, look, I'll come with you. We haven't got any sound recorders. I don't know where we're going to go. I have no idea what places we're going to be at, but I know we're going to be in the middle of nowhere. We're going to be searching down holy men. And I said, but maybe we can make this into a film as we do it. So he agreed to come along, and I've managed to capture it all on camera, which I've made into a movie called Mystic Journey to India, which has now just this week gone on to Amazon, so people could actually see this, see what happened on video. But and it was all professionally put together because Louis was able to edit it all, and we actually captured it all, most of it, but some of it was just happening so fast. For example, one of the most incredible things, it said in the Oracle, now we had to go to various holy places around India. And these were beautiful places and such mind-opening places anyway. But one of the things it said, you're going to meet, you have, Mr. Prakash, who became my Nadi guide through it, he said, right, now we have to find holy man. I go, okay, yeah. And he said in the Oracle where it would be. The Oracle, he looked at the almanac, and we got to get there at such and such a time when Mercury's in this position. Okay. So he was kind of using his almanac and the Nadi leaves as a sort of sat-nav. So we headed off through swamps and down dust roads into the middle of nowhere, up a hill, and then just as we're going up this hill, a dusty hill high up in the Himalaya, high up in the Indian, South Indian mountains, the car breaks down, bang. And we step out the car and think, where's this holy man? And as we stepped out the car, the holy man stepped out of the bushes behind us. He was all covered in ash. His eyes are sort of red. Red, almost demonic red eyes he had. And this man apparently, because I found out later, sleeps in a fire. He doesn't just walk through fire. He lays down and can sleep in a fire. He's what they call a siddha yogi.
He sleeps all night in burning embers.
Not all night, but he will lay down and sleep in a fire in front of his devotees, apparently. You know?
Have you witnessed this?
No, I didn't witness it.
Oh, you didn't. Okay.
But my God, what an interesting strange man. All his hair is like it looks like Marge Simpson haircut, you know. All matted with dirt, and you know, it was like, oh my God, here I am. Look, I can't believe what I'm looking at. So I follow him, right, and I follow through. And we walk up this hill, up this dusty hill, to this temple on top of the hill. And then he hadn't apparently appeared there for over a year. And at that very moment, he stepped out and walked into the temple. The very moment that Nadi said to be in that place at that time. Right?
He was expecting you.
It was someone 5,000 years ago knew of that very moment that I would follow that man. You know, you can imagine what that does to your head.
What did he tell you?
Well, we had to follow him around the temple, and all this banging goes on, and he goes around all these shrines and things and starts doing all these rituals with fire going everywhere. It was a real amazing eye candy thing to watch, you know. Like, got my cameraman friend was just saying, this is incredible. Then we thought it was all over, about to go, and someone comes up and grabs me by the arm. He wants to see you. He wants to see you. And he pulled me over by my arm to see him. And he stood up on a sort of a level slightly above me, and you kneel down and touch his feet. And then he starts spouting off in Tamil about all these things, you know, as if not looking at me, just talking in Tamil. Right, so I didn't understand what he said. And when finished and came away from him, I asked, what was all that about, and what did he say? Well, then Mr. Prakash then translated through his friend. Now, it's quite difficult. Getting the translations is difficult because the Indian language is so hard to hear sometimes. But what he basically said was the same predictions that had been said in the Nadi Oracle. I couldn't believe it. I was getting confirmation now from, and what he was saying was the things that were said in the very first Nadi Oracle, something that Mr. Prakash, who was with me, knew nothing about. So I was getting confirmation from the first, I said I did it in two lots, and the first that came from the very first reading. Oh, blimey. You know, not only has the Nadi told me to do this and what's going to happen, but I now get a holy man telling me all about it too.
This is incredible. But I have to ask you about the date of your death. I'm not going to ask you to divulge it, but I'm hoping that it's a long ways into the future.
Well, it's not round the corner, thank goodness.
Yes, you live to a ripe old age.
It does, you know, it's kind of, there's a funny thing to you, you know. It's a bit, I think it's in the story of Sparta, I think there's a story where someone in Sparta is told by the gods the day he will die, so becomes fearless in battle, right? And
right.
It kind of gives you this fearlessness in a way, in a funny sort of way, because you know that that's when your time's going to come. You think, well, it's not going to come till then, you know, so I'll be fearless with life. And the strange thing is, though, you know, I told you that because I wanted to test this oracle, I tested it a number of different times, and in the end ended up talking to a number of different readers I tracked down through these people and connections I had in India. But as you do these rituals, because I did the rituals in the stages, as you do the rituals, the next time I approached the oracles, it said, you have done the rituals, you have done the remedies, your date of death has shifted 5 years further.
Ah.
You've gained 5 years.
Interesting.
No, I didn't expect that. But apparently, the thumbprint itself has these little dots on it. And those dots even change as you do as you change your karmic remedy. So even the thumbprint starts to change.
Wait a second. If you had the oracle in front of you right now, the Knotty Leaf Oracle, could you see the letters in this ancient Tamil writing actually change before your eyes?
This is another one that I consulted. This is called the Jiva Nadi. Now, there's a couple of other oracles in India. There's one set of leaves that you can ask about current situations, and the writing actually changes. It's a blank leaf, and the writing appears on it.
Have you witnessed that?
I didn't witness it, but I consulted it.
Okay.
And it gave me an equally interesting read. But my friend who was introduced me to it, he had seen this, and another one called the Pothai, which is where they put a metal plate into a fire, and it will come out with the predictions in English. So my friend had witnessed that one, so I'm hoping to track that one down next. I want to go to India again, do another mystic journey to India, and find the Pothai and find the Jivanadi.
All right. Well, we're not done with this. We're not done with this journey yet. We'll take a time out, come back, and continue to delve into the Knotty Leaf Oracle and the mystical journey to India with British psychic medium Craig Hamilton Parker. Here is Lady Ella and Louie taking us into the break with Dream a Little Dream on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, SYRETT. And before we get back to our conversation with Craig Hamilton Parker, British psychic medium, and this remarkable mystical journey in India and the Knotty Leaf Oracle, just a reminder, again, George Norrie coming to Salt Lake City Saturday, March the 10th, 5 to 8 p.m., and what a cast of remarkable experts he's bringing with him. Ancient technology expert Jason Martell, the man who died two times and lived to tell about it, Danian Brinkley, a ufologist, Nick Pope. George will sing a few songs with a live band. You can take part in a Q&A with each guest, and there'll be a meet and greet following the show. Don't miss out. Tickets will go fast. And here's the box office number. Take this down. 801-355-ARTS. That's 801-355-2787. Or online tickets, artsaltlake.org. Sorry, artsaltlake.org. Artsaltlake.org. And then, very quickly, Saturday, April the 21st, George lands in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Virginia G. Piper Theater. And in tow will be spirit traveler Sonia Grace, astronomer, master of all things space, Dr. Sky Steve Cates. And they will end the evening with a UFO roundtable featuring some of the most respected people in ufology today, including Dr. Lynn Kitai from the Phoenix Lights, Melinda Leslie, Travis Walton, and John D'Souza. And again, tickets will go fast, so call the box office, 480-499-8587. This is for the Scottsdale event now. 480-499-8587, scottsdalearts.org. scottsdalearts.org to order tickets online. All right, back with one more go at Craig Hamilton Parker and the mystical journey to India right here on Coast to Coast AM. Craig Hamilton Parker, British psychic medium, and the website is psychics.co.uk, psychics.co.uk. I'm going to ask a real pedestrian question, Craig, and that is, how is it possible that everybody who seeks the oracle could have seven pages dedicated to them, their chapter in the oracle? How is that physically possible?
Well, there's thousands of these leads. I mean, how is it possible to even, for a seer 5,000 years ago, to see things like computers, see things like trains, like they describe a train, for example, a long carriage with lots of wheels on a track. You know, that's a train, you know, an iron bird that flies in the sky, you know, an aeroplane, you know, the medium of light and sound, television and the internet, you know.
Right.
I mean, I can't begin to explain it. I mean, these leads were so valuable in the past. They were kept in the temples and were kept underneath specific temples that had been built for the leads. When the British Raj came over there, they destroyed a lot of the leads, took all the leaves, took some off to the British Museum, and then sold some back to families that are now using the oracle sections of them. So this was a big tradition in India. There must have been thousands of scribes working on it in its time. It's considered as one of the lost wonders of India. And the thing is, now people are going to be keen to say, oh, I'm going to go and find that Nadi oracle. I have to warn, though, because we live in what in India they call the age of Kali Yuga, the age of darkness. The oracle has been often corrupted, and most people out there doing the oracle are dodgy people that you must not part your money to. I only paid what I wanted to pay for the reading. I gave about $70, I think it was, for the reading, right? Which I thought was fair, you know, because it would cover their costs. But I didn't have to give anything. There's other oracles out there at the moment saying, oh, we'll give you, you can read your Nadi. And I looked at this one and said, $2,000 the reading. And I thought, no, see, that's corrupted. And even some of the ones that I've seen since have suddenly, Westerns have come along, and one or two of them have gone down the route of, oh, we'll charge a lot of money for this, you know.
Right, right. So,
it's like chasing a living thing. I think of it as a guru. I think of it as a real person speaking to me from the ancient past.
Does the oracle care whether you're open to it or not? So, for example, if I was looking for the oracle and I wanted to find my chapter in the oracle, but the oracle, I'm talking about it as if it's a living thing, but if it perceived that I was close-minded, would it reveal itself to me?
Yes. You can be as skeptic as you like. It will give you 100% answers no matter how skeptical you are. Like I say, you only answer yes or no to the oracle, and it will just give exactly what's said on the leaf. As long as you've got a true reader, this is the problem, you see. So some of them, for example, will say, well, I won't tell them that bit about their death, or I'll gloss that up, or might add a few extra predictions in that are bad ones so I can make a bit more money out of this. You see, a corrupt reader can destroy the oracle. As long as you can find the pure one, and that took a bit of doing. And that's why I've had to use, you know, like the man that had been researching it for over 30 years, I described, and my friend who we met back in 1995, he was looking for it since then. You know, this is why most of it's kept secret still, and you have to really track it down. But if you can find it, people say to me, oh, tell me who do you recommend? I can't do that because it's so volatile, this thing. You have to find the correct one at the correct time in the correct place. But, you know, I do personal recommendations to take people there to show it to them, and I don't want any money for anything like that. I do it as a public service to people sometimes. But that's only when, you know, people I know face-to-face and have met, and I've taken to it have come across just as mind-boggling, even more mind-boggling things than I've described in my story here today.
Well, take us back to your journey then. After you met this yogi who sleeps in fire,
yep.
What happened next?
Well, because none of it had been planned in advance, but we had to just follow the oracle. We ended up going all over southern India. We did about 2,000 miles we worked at. And most of the time, I didn't even know where I was a lot of the time. And we went. I did various rituals, like I had to do a ritual to a homa, which is like a fire ceremony in which you throw all these fragrances onto a fire. It takes all day, and you throw buckets of water over you and things like this for cleansing, and all sorts of strange odd thing rituals and things like this that I did. But then one of the most important parts, the most emotionally important part to me was doing the charitable work, because the idea is that, you know, when you do a good act to somebody else, they have good thoughts about you. And those thoughts about you, because this whole system is based on the idea that consciousness is a real living thing, that the Nadi itself is a living consciousness, and that we can change our destiny by having good thoughts coming towards us to help break a pattern of negative thoughts from previous lives. So when you do a charitable act, not only does it do good to the person, but it also does good to you at the same time because of the positive actions that creates. So I did a lot of charitable things, such as going around villages and feeding remote villages with food and things like that. And that was beautiful to do that. It was just so, you know, because charities, you know, you put money in charities, and they for every dollar you put in, I think 1 cent gets to the person who needs it, you know?
Right, the administration costs and the overhead.
I can put all the money into this, you know?
Right.
By just taking some food to villages. But then I gave one of the remedies that the oracle said was to give a cow to an old person, old couple, cow and a calf. So we bought a cow, we bought a calf, and that moment that I gave the rope to the cow to the old lady, it was just so, I cried, you know, because...
Yeah, you changed her life with that simple gift.
Yeah, I could feel it changing me, and I could feel it changing them, because it's like giving a person a pension. You know,
yes.
A cow's not just meat in India, it's not at all meat. It can give you a complete livelihood, a cow. It can sort you out the rest of your life. And that was beautiful to do. And we went also to, and gave fed children in a sort of an asylum for young children, and they're all well behaved. And that was another beautiful thing to do. It's so humbling. And I was thinking about my wife Jane, you know, because as you said at the top of the show that she'd been a psychiatric nurse in her time, and
yes.
I thought, yes, faint, strange, but my life is now helping people with psychiatric problems too. And when you're putting that food on the plate, it's almost because I tuned in so much to India, I was so attuned. It was like I was in another world through this whole period, because I'd been to such holy places and holy mountains and holy caves. And when I was putting the food on, it was like it was changing me as it's helping them. It was like on a high level of consciousness these things happen. And people that take this journey in the same way seem to experience it like I did, you know. You step into another order of reality, you know.
Right.
You've accepted this strange order of reality that's in the Nadi leaves.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, were you all in, for example, if the Nadi Oracle had instructed you to give everything you owned away, would you have?
I probably would have done that. I don't know. I was all in by the time I'd finished, because I found it overwhelmingly spiritually transformative.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just me talking myself into something. It's because I've experienced so many things as a medium through my life. I've seen physical mediumship type things happen. I've made people fall off their chair when I've given evidence to people. But this was in another order of reality. This was something that was happening on a deep level. And in fact, what it's made me want to do, and my wife Jane feels the same, is maybe want to donate the rest of my life to doing spiritual things as a form of service to others. And that is really giving everything. So in actual fact, I suppose on one level, I'm not there yet, but I'm trying to, is to give everything to the idea of service to this higher energy, what some might call God.
Right. So what happened? You work your way through this journey, and you tick all the boxes. Okay, we've accomplished that. Next. So when do you know that you're done?
You never are done, because I might consult it again in the future, and the oracle probably knows I will have consulted it, and I may never consult it again. I may not feel I need to. I think when are we done at all in this world, really? I mean, I talk about a mystic journey to India, but life itself is a journey to somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
When do we know we've got to the end of that journey? it's not just death. We know it's not just death because we continue after death, and maybe we come back to this world again. So the journey seems to be endless. But the journey perhaps is done when we have become the journey, when we have entered into a state of becoming spiritually awake, of becoming self-realized. And that's where the journey goes from and to. And it's a journey from yourself to yourself, I think, in the end.
Right. I mean, it's internal more than anything, isn't it?
Well, it's internal, but also the more I look at this, because of the strange synchronicity of things, the way coincidences would happen and things like this on the trip, you know, I mean, things would happen exactly the right time, you know. I began to realize that the external world and the internal world are the same thing. Because as changes were happening in me, things were happening in the external world around me, you know. I mean, we went to Mount Arunachana, and it had been closed for ages and ages, apparently. When we got to it, they opened the gate to let people in to go up Mount Arunachana again, because the path had been being redone for 6 months. I was the first one to step through, you know.
Ah,
I thought, well, that's
remarkable.
Little things
right.
Like that, all the time.
But we always tend to associate a mystical journey with places, you know, far-flung corners of the world. You mentioned India, or, you know, we're to find the meaning of life on some summit in Nepal. Who's to say it's not to be found in a pawn shop in Newark, New Jersey?
Absolutely. And here I am in a little suburb in the UK, and I'm just as where I was there as I am here, as it were, you know. The journey is from yourself to yourself. I mean, we don't, you know, it's the world... Are we passing through the world, or is the world passing through us, you know? Because everything is just a stream of consciousness, ultimately. And what we're experiencing out there and what we're experiencing inside ourselves are one and the same thing. So it doesn't matter where you are in the world. You know, you don't have to go to India. But for me, I needed to go to India to do those rituals, those remedies, to change my karma and to break the bond of previous lives. And that's what I wrote about in Mystic Journey to India, the book, and that's what I filmed when we went to India and did the rituals and put it on Amazon. The Mystic Journey to India is a journey, but it's a journey into yourself, into your own awakening. And that's really the message that of itself comes out of this story.
And the documentary available now on Amazon. Any plans for a feature film, not a fictionalized version, but more of a theatrical type version?
Well, we've been to Cannes and we have spoken to people, so people got very interested in this, and we're hoping to be able to do something on a bigger scale. It's early stages, and who knows? The Oracle seems to point to things like that, strangely enough. But in a way, you kind of... I know in this world, you know, in America and England, we have to always be so ambitious, but it teaches you to kind of stop and let it happen, and it'll come on its own accord. And I'm hoping that, you know, the right thing will come along to help turn it into something that will take it to another scale. Because I'd like to, I mean, I've also explored northern India, and I found other oracles in India, like the Nadi. And I'd like to know a lot more about what they say about the future of the world, because I found a few things in there like that. And even in some of these Nadis, you know, there's even talk about other planets, you know, life on other planets. And I've not found that myself, but I've heard about this. And of course, once you get into this whole Indian mindset, there's perhaps a lot of fantasy there, but you keep finding all sorts of interesting paths to explore, to mysteries that are, you know, so mind-boggling. Come on, Craig, come back to reality. You know?
I can hear it in your voice how passionate you are about this. I mean, you can't fake that. Although, you know, I was thinking while you were talking about destiny and so forth, you know, the next time my wife asks me to trim the hedges or cut the grass, maybe I'll tell her it's the Knotty Leaf Oracle. I've consulted it, and it's not in my destiny. So I don't know if she'll buy it or not. Very quickly.
Work is worship. See all actions as being a divine calling.
That's true. You know, that's true. I enjoy washing the dishes. I find it very contemplative.
To do that.
Well, I want to just very quickly in the time that remains, we just have a couple of minutes, but the titles of your book, some of them are very provocative. And one is What to Do When You Die. What should you do when you die, besides
what
just lie there?
When you're dead, the book is the actual.
What to do when you're dead?
That's
yes.
My book about the afterlife, and you know, it questions about what happens when we die. What is the reality? What is the world like over there? You know, is it like this world? Is it a dreamlike lucid state? So I've drawn upon my experiences, plus the experiences people have near-death experiences, plus the traditional things, and brought it all together and tried to give us some understanding about what life is like, what time is life like, whether it's the same as this world, and whether we come back again.
So a bit of an instructional manual on how to navigate through the other side?
Partly, yeah, partly. It looks at a lot of the questions about, you know, and the misconceptions about life after death, as I see it too, you know, and how do we get direct proof ourselves, you know? How can we prove it other than just dying?
Right, right. In terms of the dream world, when we have visitations from people that have passed on, how do we differentiate between something that's just a dream and what is an actual visitation from that person from the other side?
Yeah, of course, that's always a different. And that's the same with mediumship, which is a thought from spirit and which is my own thoughts. And it's the same problem in the dream world. But the only I've always noticed that, you know, if there's certain dreams that have a certain quality to them that is beyond what is a normal symbolic emotional dream, as it were. I mean, the holy men, for example, can meet you in your dreams. This is one of the things the oracles told me. He said, we'll give you instructions through your dreams. And I dream of the holy man that wrote the Anadi Oracle and tells me things. And those dreams are totally different to normal dreams. They're like being wide awake in a dream, lucid. And that's the same often when you get a contact from the spirit world. If a person wants to make a connection with you, it's often of a certain quality that is beyond the normal dream. And so, you know, because emotional dreams, a lot often when people, for example, when they dream of someone who's died, they'll often have a dream of like they've been divorced or something horrible, because it's like their feelings being expressed that they've let me go,
right.
I've been left alone, you know. But that's not a real dream of the person. That's an emotional, symbolic dream.
Craig, I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. Thank you so much for hanging out with me.
Great pleasure.
Psychics.co.uk. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyons, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Greg Bishop, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, here in Toronto, Mike Ben Dixon, and Patrick O'Neill, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. This is Coast to Coast AM. Until tonight, so long for now.